So many people have sent me a video link to an interview that Ian Puddick did on his YouTube channel with Paul Page. I watched the interview. I can see why you guys out there are interested in Paul's story. I immediately downloaded For Queen and Currency on my Kindle. I've been absolutely gripped by it. Here's a picture of Paul when he was starting out in the police as a young man. And Paul actually worked his way up, whereby he became a Royal Protection Officer. He was a cop letting the Queen in Buckingham Palace, raising the barrier, and also he was a Royal Protection Officer for Prince Andrew. Now, everybody on the channel who's into the Epstein case has watched the BBC interview with Virginia Roberts. You've watched the Panorama special. You've watched the BBC interview with Prince Andrew, in which he melted down his entire career. Now, Paul was approached by Panorama, and it has not been published. And this is the first time, apart from what he's done with Ian Puddick, it was more of a shorter clip on that channel. This is the first time now that Paul has spoke at length, got his entire story out there, unedited, all in his own words. No agenda, out to the viewers out there. But thank you for coming on, Paul. I'd just like to start then. You said that Panorama contacted you. Yeah. They were going to do something. Could you just run down what happened there, please?
Yeah. Basically, as I said to you before, excuse me, the reason that I started this all occurred was because about August time, I found myself being thrown back into the public light with stories about Prince Andrew and quotes that I said years ago, and I thought to myself, well, what I'm going to do is, rather than the press keep suddenly putting me in the papers without my knowledge, I'm going to do a Twitter account. And that's what I did. So I started posting information about, from my own words, about what I knew about Prince Andrew, my thoughts and what was going on, and then shortly after the August sort of newspaper editions that had come out, I was approached by Darren McIntyre from the BBC, and basically he spent a couple of hours with me and explained that what I'd said 10 years previously about Prince Andrew, allegations I'd made about him in relation to the way he conducted himself, that they were very interested in interviewing me and putting that on a Panorama special. So I considered it, and in the end I agreed to do it, and basically the interview took place in London. About a week, 2 weeks later. It was a comprehensive interview. I sort of spoke about what I knew about Prince Andrew, not what I suspected or what I guessed, what I actually knew, as in what I'd seen myself and what I'd heard. As you know, obviously, I've been to prison. I've got no agenda. I served my time and I deserve what I got. But there was no reason for me to come out of prison and start causing issues or telling lies. So everything that I said to Dara for the BBC interview was true. The other thing worth noting is that the times and the things that I've said and will tell you, I was in company with other police officers. So it's not like I was on my own and it cannot be corroborated. What I'm saying is the officers that I was with are too frightened to come forward to corroborate it, but they're certainly not going to come forward and deny it. So I'm quite comfortable if there's anyone, when I say what I say today, I've got an issue with it, please come forward and we'll discuss it. So yeah, I did the interview, a comprehensive interview about what I knew about Prince Andrew. It was all good. At the same time though, I was contacted by Channel 4 Dispatches, who also wanted me to take part in a documentary for them. But the BBC were insistent that I didn't assist them, as they wanted to retain exclusivity on what I'd said. So I agreed. So I refused to participate in the Channel 4 documentary, which was about Prince Andrew, which came out just prior to the BBC interview. And then unfortunately, because of a chain of events, which I was told from the Dara, they uncovered some new information in the States. So therefore my sort of interview was to be cut, unfortunately, which I was disappointed because I think, when you look at Prince Andrew, there's not a lot of people out there who are actually telling the public or telling people what he is really like as the person off duty, people see him and other members of the royal family on the telly, waving and smiling. But behind closed doors, certainly from my experience with Prince Andrew, it's a totally different kettle of fish, which is what I explained at the time.
And I was completely gripped by your interactions with Prince Andrew. Mm. Ghislaine Maxwell was going in there, meeting him. Mm. The way Prince Andrew talked down to his staff and cursed at the staff. Mm. We are going to get to that. I'd like to start out, though, Paul, by asking, what motivated you to join the police?
Well, it's actually quite funny because I had a motivation to join the emergency. So I wanted to join the army initially. When I actually joined the Territorial Army, I served for 3 years in the TA. But I wanted to become a fireman. But unfortunately, London Fire Brigade weren't recruiting. So I ended up throwing an application into Essex Police and was accepted and ended up becoming a police officer within Essex Police, based at Grays, where I live.
And was that your initial position? Were you just a beat cop or
just
what?
A beat cop. Just, I mean, going back to them days, you know, people, the police services, or we used to call it the police force, and that's the police service, but it's changed a lot. Back in them days, you're a young PC, you're the lowest of the low in the pecking order. That means you're walking the beat. You don't get to go in a car for at least 6 months. Every pile of, pardon my French, shit that comes through the letterbox, as in like, crime complaints that no one else wants to deal with, then you're dealing with it. It's to build your experience up. But yeah, so I sort of cut my teeth, as it were, in Grays Police Station as a young PC. Yeah.
What challenges arose during those early years?
I think really and truly, because when you're dealing with a county force, because the Met had a bad reputation, do all police forces have bad reputation? I don't know. But back in the day, the Met had a bad reputation for violence and whatever else. But the Met had 30,000 odd coppers. Essex only had 2,500. So the challenges that were different between the Met and Essex were quite simple. If you went to a pub fight, you had to use your speaking skills, your sort of persuasive skills rather than your physical skills to break stuff. Sometimes you'd have to get stuck in, but if you turned up to a place where there was a lot of people, you had to do a lot more talking and a lot less, you know, fighting until your backup came. Whereas what I noticed in the Met was, and I'm not slagging off colleagues because it's just how it was, they were more quick to use physical force because there were so many of them. So the skills that I learned were in Essex were invaluable to me because it wasn't all about throwing people on the floor and handcuffing. It was about verbal communication and one-to-one interaction, rather than trying to tell someone what they're going to do. Ask them what you know, this is how we're going to do. Do you know what I mean? There's a difference in how you approach people. How can I put it? When I went to the Met, so many officers in one place, there were officers who would start a fight in an empty room, you know, and those would stick out in Essex because you'd think, hold up, you can't act like that down there because you haven't got enough people to walk around doing stuff like that. But Essex was a completely different kettle of fish. Everyone was tight-knit, you know, all the officers were together. But in the Met, you're just a number, you're not a name, you're just a number, which makes a lot of difference.
So you wanted to be a fireman. That's someone who's helping society, facing danger. You become a policeman, also helping society, facing danger. When it becomes a reality for you, when you're confronting those dangers head on, I imagine you got attacked or whatever happened in the early years, you got in some situations, were you thinking, this is definitely the career path I want to be on?
Yeah. I mean, when I joined the police, I was already an England karate international. So I'd won British and English titles, so I could look after myself physically. I remember when I first was assaulted as a police officer, which changed my perception of how I dealt with people in terms of my physical approach, as it were. I was on the beat in Grays Town Centre on my own. I was only 20 odd, and I've only been in the job, I don't know, 6 months, whatever it was. And I come across this gentleman. He was loud, he was abusive to passers-by, he was throwing stuff about. So it was a case of me just going over and needing to talk to him to quieten him down and send him on his way, which is what I thought was going to happen. But that's not what happened. as I approached him and tried to talk to him, he became aggressive and then violent, and a struggle ensued. And because, although I could physically take care of myself, but because I was wearing a police uniform, I was thinking, I'm not in a street fight now. I'm a police officer. I can't give him a right hand. I've got to try and restrain him. And in doing so, he's headbutted me straight in the mouth. And even then, I was still frightened of really defending myself, because I felt that I'm going to get myself in trouble anyway. Ended up to the floor. Other officers came and he was arrested. And all I wanted to do was tell him, quiet down, pick up the rubbish and send him on his way. No more, no less. And then he got charged with assault on police. And we went to Crown Court, and I'll never forget it. I went there to Snaresbrook Crown Court, and he got off and got found not guilty. And that changed my perception of the law. Then that changed how I conducted myself from there on in, because I thought, you know what? I'm not going to get hit again. I'm not going to give anyone the chance to hit me in that situation. So after that, I became a different sort of police officer. I was still I could speak to you, but if I felt there was going to be any form of danger, then I'd make sure that I was the first person to put you, restrain you, ask questions later. Because then I realised the job is actually quite dangerous. But up until that point, when you wear a uniform, you don't really realise that someone could quite easily turn around and smack you in the face, or in their days, snap you. And it's a wake-up call.
Respect for the karate. When I got out of prison, I joined the dojo. Mm. And I'd been conditioned in prison whereby, if anyone says anything to you, you've got to react right away. I went with the black belts one night. They watched some fight in London. Mm. They're walking back over a bridge in Guildford, and there's a load of drunks kicking a can, and one of them jumped in front of the karate guys like, the karate guys walked through these guys as if they didn't even exist. Mm. And I'm thinking, right, all hell's going to break loose here, because in prison, someone jumps in front of your face like that. Yeah. How old were you when you started karate?
I was eight.
Eight?
I was eight, yeah. I got my black belt when I was 14.
Wow.
Got in the England squad when I was 16.
England squad?
Yeah, joined the England squad. In fact, it's a funny story. Was when I got in the England squad, the England cadets it was initially. It was the first cadet squad. We got invited up to the Houses of Parliament to meet our MPs. This is a true story. And we all went up there. There was about 20 of us. And we got put in this reception hall, and all our MPs came in. I can't remember. I think mine was Harry Cohen at the time. Bless him, he didn't turn up. And anyway, Boris Johnson came in. And this is a true story. He came in and came up to us and was chatting away, and had this big blonde mop of hair like he does. And he said, "Oh, karate, are you? Yeah, what are you doing there? Where are you going?" I said, "Oh, we're going to the European Karate Championships." So he said, "Oh, really, really?" So, "Oh, what are you doing there?" So we're telling him what we did. Anyway, mustache now. And he gave my friend a little fake fist pump on the old chest and went, "Make sure you beat the Japanese." So someone said, "Who the fuck was that?" I said, "I think it was Jeffrey out of Rainbow, wasn't it?" Yeah, make sure you beat the Japanese. Oh, fuck, couldn't believe it.
So you had a black belt by 14.
Yeah,
and did you get more dans?
No, I went to first dan, and then I think I got my second dan later on. But then what happened was, I went by the time I hit 21, and I literally was in the England squad. So I was training. I was fighting competitions every week, because I won the British and English titles. And then by 21, I was in the police. Because I joined the Territorial Army when I was 17. I was a lifeguard at a leisure centre as well, like a fitness instructor, as well as at the same time. And then I joined the police. And when you join the police, that's it. I was taken away. I had to move. I had to go in digs. So my sort of karate career sort of levelled out then.
Would being at that level of karate, would that be the police look at that as... we should get this guy in. He's got the techniques to put people down and, restrain them and things like that.
It was an advantage. It was an advantage because obviously I didn't do, when I went to police college, I ended up being one of the instructors. So I walked in with a black belt and the instructors only had brown belts. So they said, "Oh, do you know what? You can help train them." So my supposed training was me training the rest of the recruits, as it were. Obviously, I learnt the police holes, but I knew most of them anyway. We because back in them days, we used to do milling as well. I don't know if you know what milling is, do you? It's you put the gloves on and you just hit each other as hard as you can. The SAS program, they do it in there. They don't do that nowadays. The recruits, they wouldn't do it there. But back in them days, they used to still do milling. And what that does is it gets you used to being hit, which I think, from a self-defense point of view and my knowledge, that if you're a police officer, you have a duty of care to yourself first and foremost, then to your family, and then to the public. And what I mean by that is you should be as fit as you can be, and you should know how to take care of yourself. Because if you can't, then you're a liability, not only to yourself, but the people you're working with. So maybe I'm right and wrong in saying this, but when I see officers who are too skinny or too fat, I think you're a liability. Because if you're 20 stone and your colleague's getting a kicking down the road and you can't run, and if you can run, by the time you get there, you're in no fit state to do anything about it, then there's an issue. And I think what's lost in police service today is a lot of discipline when it comes to fitness. And it's not really just police officers' faults. It's the police forces, because the budget cuts, they're sporting sort of arms of whatever they had, rugby clubs, football clubs, boxing clubs, they've been gradually reduced. And the time that police officers get, or the time they used to get, they don't get now to perform. You know, I mean, I was a heavyweight boxing champion in Met. I used to do the Lafone Cup year in, year out. And we used to get time to train. But nowadays, you don't get time. It's got to be on your own time. And I think that's very important for a police officer nowadays. Or anyone who wants to join the police, make sure you're fit and you know how to handle yourself.
You made an interesting comment earlier. You said that you decided to, upon a different response when you got in another situation, you wouldn't get hit. Now, in karate, they teach you some lethal things, you know, snapping necks and bird beak strike in the eyeball. Mm. What level did you decide to take it to restrain someone?
Right, so that initial contact, although I knew that I could knock this person out in seconds, I could give him a good hiding, I was restrained and was frightened because I was wearing a police uniform. And really and truly, I was being attacked. So I should have realised that I can do what I needed to do in order to restrain this person. If it means I've got to punch him on the nose, and basically punch him on the nose will make his eyes water and make it hard for him to see, for example. I'm not talking about punching him in the throat because my life wasn't in danger. But I'm talking about doing something that is a measured response in order to retain my safety and, in fact, retain the safety of this person. Then I have to know, I have to do something. So my next, obviously I didn't do it at that time because, as I said to you, I was only in the job 6 months, but then I learnt the lesson when I went to Snaresbrook County Court, and this person who was guilty of assault on police walked. Now, a lot of people who watch your programme were going to say, good, because you're a copper and that's what happens. Well, no, I'm a human being. I'm a member of the public as well. And I was there to do a job. I wasn't there to bully anyone. I wasn't there to pick on anyone. He was causing a disturbance and he was intimidating people. And that's why I went to do something about it. So my level, as you want to call it, the next level to me was, I will drop you before, if you're a threat to me, and it's called a preemptive strike. If you're a threat to me and I look at you and I think you're going to do something, you're going on the floor first. I'm going to restrain you and then we're going to talk about it. You know, I'm not talking about giving someone a whack. Because the other thing I find as well with police, and this is why you get a lot of assault on police getting done for assault, because they're not physically capable, right? They don't go gym or whatever, they suddenly decide they're going to get their ass back, they're going to get their batting out, or they're going to get their CS bright. And I'm not going against their thought process, but what I'm saying is, if they were more physically aware and more physically confident, maybe they wouldn't need to have used those tactical options. Maybe they could have, if they were strong enough to restrain the person, which then obviously lessens the injury of the person they're arresting. It's not always going to be the case. In some cases, you're going to need to hit someone hard around the head with an asp. If your life's in danger or you're in trouble, I'm sorry, whatever people think of the police, you've got to do what you've got to do to be the one walking away. Who wants to end up on a mortuary slab? I've seen it with police officers. I've seen police officers that are too frightened to do what they need to do and they've got hurt badly.
I hear you 100%. I mean, if someone was going to attack a police officer, I think that person would be lucky to attack someone like you, who was a skilled martial artist and knew how to minimise that situation.
As I said, and I was a self-defence instructor in Essex Police for a while, and then I was one of the top instructors for the Met, and I was one of the heads of self-defence for the Royal Protection Command, hence why I went to the Royal Protection Command, because they wanted me as one of the instructors. But I've always said, you know, the police get a bad reputation for, listen, I've hit people that I shouldn't have hit, sex cases and nonsense. I'll be honest with you. I've hit street robbers. I've done things that I shouldn't have done. But is it illegal? Is it wrong legally? Yes. But morally is a different kettle of fish. If you've caught someone who's just beaten up an old lady and robbed them of her jewellery, I'm not taking any chances with you. I'm going to give you a good hiding. And then when I know you can't do anything, but I'm going to handcuff you. It's as simple as that. I'm not going to do that to an innocent person, but I've done it. And the problem you get is there's a crossover of what's right and what's wrong. Well, we all know what's wrong. But if I put you in a police uniform and I showed you an old lady with her nose broken and a couple of teeth missing, and I showed you a very nasty individual who's got previous for it, and you're now chasing this person down, and he turns round to you and he's not going to come quietly, you've got two choices. You can either walk away with your tail between your legs or deal with the situation, you know. And back in them days, there was a lot of disquiet amongst the police about criminals getting away with too much. And there was. I mean, back in Paul Condon's day, he even said, and you can have a look at this and people can read up on it, that there's a lot of corruption is being caused because of the court system and how they let people off so lightly. And what that did was, the ripple effect was, it caused corruption within the police. And it did back in the day, you know. Like I said, bent for the job. The term bent for the job means you're bent in terms of you will go to whatever lengths you need to get a conviction of someone you know is committing continual criminal offences.
I've got one more karate question before we go back to your story then, because I've wondered about this. So I've watched a video of the London terrorist attack. So let's say one of the guys who put that guy down, and he had that suicide belt strapped on him. Let's say one of those guys had been a martial artist and he had gone all the way and snapped that guy's neck and killed him. In the eyes of the law, would he be charged with something then?
No, he'd be fine. He'd be fine. You know, when I looked at that, personally, I wonder why they didn't, when they took that knife off him, they didn't put him in, the knife was taken away. I don't know if you saw that.
But yeah, no, I saw the guy running away with the knife.
That was a clear case of the man, he'd already stabbed two people, and obviously we now know he killed them, and he was looking to kill more people. So if someone had snapped his neck, then that would have been fine. That would have been justification in self-defense.
Watching the video, did you wonder if you were there, what you would have done?
If I could have got to the knife, that was taken away, I would have stuck it in him. What else could you do? You know, that would have been a clear case of you're preserving life. You know, you're there to protect and preserve life. And that would have been one of them cases where it would have been clear that you had to do that. You know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he had that belt on. You could have gone off at any second if it
was
real.
Well, I mean, I looked at that and I thought, if you know, when they got hold of him, I was wondering if they were going to throw him over the bridge. You know, if you've got a suspected vest on, you know, I mean, back in the days, we were trained, and I'm going back 20-odd years ago now, when all this sort of suicide vest started coming out, we were secretly trained in the Lippitt Seal and the firearms courses to two officers grab arms and the other one shoot in the back of the head. So you'd have three officers, you know, one either end holding the arms out and the other one shooting the suspect in the head. You're trained to do that.
Yeah, you got to kill them as fast as possible.
In case, you know, in Buckingham Palace is one of them places, the same as Parliament, where you've got officers on the gate and you could easily get, and it happened in Parliament. You know, why they didn't have armed officers when that poor PC got killed on the gate, on that gate. And I'm pretty sure it was to do because the MPs didn't want armed officers on the gates. But they have to remember that is a building that is subject to attacks from all kinds of people. You know, we get threat levels each week. I think the threat level is assessed to see where it is in response to our whatever we're protecting. So it could be Buckingham Palace, it could be Parliament, it could be the same threat level throughout the country. And really and truly, if there was armed officers on that post at the time, they could have took that person out. He wouldn't have even got in the gates, you know, which is a bit annoying for me when I see that PC, as brave as he was, you know, and he his life was just wasted, you know.
Okay, so going back to your early years then, you mentioned that you saw officers who didn't know how to behave in a violent situation get hurt. Yeah. Have you got any stories you can describe about that?
I've got one. We all used to have nicknames, and I mean, I remember one fella, bless him. We used to call him Wilf. The reason we called him Wilf, he was his own young lad, but he was a neighbourhood beat officer. But he had quite a posh accent, and you know, he was a neighbourhood beat officer, but he loved to spend his time in old people's homes, sitting having cups of tea and drinking, you know, eating biscuits, which is why he got the nickname Wilf, because it sounds like an old person, doesn't it? So bless him, Wilf used to ride around on a bike through Grey's Tent and Centre with his trousers with the cycle things on. He didn't look the most macho of officers, do you know what I mean? He did get the piss ripped out of him, if I'm going to be honest. And then one day I got told that I've got to go out with him. And I ended up on a bike with, it looked horrendous. And he cycled me up to an old people's home. We sat in there for 2 hours, eating cake and drinking cups of tea. And I said to him when I come out, I said, Wilf, don't ever do that to me again. I just want to kill myself now, mate. So anyway, he wasn't a handy officer. He was one of these officers I'm telling you about. A lovely bloke. He was a good police officer. You don't all have to be, I'm not saying that everyone should be macho and running around hitting people. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is you can be a good officer and have communication skills and all the rest of it. But sometimes you're going to need a bit of muscle to, you're in a situation. And on this particular occasion, poor old Wilf, he'd gone up to Cranberville Street and there was a group of youths there causing a disturbance. And he'd gone up there on his own and they basically beat the fuck out of him. By the time we got there, he was, you know, he'd had a good hiding. And we said to him, he said, all I said to him was, you know, someone said to him, the reason you've got a kicking is because you spend too much time eating cake and drinking cups of tea in old people's homes. And it, obviously what happened, we rounded them up and back in them days, if you assaulted a police officer, I mean, and this is where you get a lot of people now going, oh, police brutality and all the rest of it. I'm not going to lie, there was brutality that I'd seen in terms of, how can I put it? Well, say brutality. So, for example, I'll give you an example. So Wilf got beaten up, right? So what we did was we rounded up the ones that had done it. And what you do is if you get someone who assaults police, basically it's the uniform they're assaulting. And what you've got to remember, if you're wearing it, you know, if it could be anyone, it could be anyone sitting watching this program now and thinking, oh, listen to what he said. Well, you put the uniform on. Don't sit in an armchair and tell me what you think unless you've been out there and you've done it. Do you know what I mean? And you think to yourself, right, you've got that uniform now. That is the only protection you've got, that uniform. So if someone touches that uniform, they're touching every other police officer in this manner. So that what I'm saying is, if you let one of them get away with touching it, they're all going to start doing it. So this is going back 25 years ago now. It was a different, you know, the way we think and the police think now. You know, obviously I'm 48 years old now. What happened then is a lot different to my mindset now, but I'm going back, the culture was different. And so we'd call up reception committee. We've got one on board, assault on police, reception committee. Well, reception committee back at the police station was police officers lined up both sides of the corridor and you come through and you get the fuck kicked out of you all the way from one end of the corridor to the other. And by the time you got to the other end of the corridor, you're never going to touch a police officer again. And that's what happened. And that back in them days, it didn't happen all the time. It happened for certain issues. Like for assaulting a police officer, you have to remember that to police officers, that's the holy grail. Because if you let one get away with it, then word goes around the manor, oh, I'll smack such and such. Well, no, that's not how it does.
And I imagine some criminals would prefer that than getting arrested and getting a 5-year sentence and getting a criminal record.
But the thing was, back in them days, people knew what the situation was.
Okay, so how many years were you in the Essex Police before the London Met?
I was in there
Met?
From 92 to 95. So about 3 years, I think.
Any other notable stories from when you were in the Essex Police before we go to the London Met?
Yeah, I'll tell you one story which made me realise that life could be short. You know, as a police officer, you never know what you're going into, do you? And I'll say it again. You know, people can judge police officers and they can judge me. I've been to prison, you know, they class me as a bent cop, which is fine, you know. But you've got to remember, when anyone puts a police uniform on, the majority of them, and I'm not going to say all of them, don't put that on thinking of themselves. They're thinking of doing something good for the public, which is true. you don't do that kind of job. When you deal with death, like when you see death and misery, it's not a nice thing to see. You know what I mean? And you don't get a lot of money for it, and you have to deal with the consequences of suicides and murders and road accidents. And I've seen it all, and it's not nice. And obviously, you know, you've got to be hardened to stuff like that. But it also brings back your own mortality. Do you know what I mean? I remember getting a call. It was late, 12 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning. And get a call. Someone's called the control. We're all sitting in the control room, and someone rings up and said, yeah, I think I heard gunshots. Or a gunshot. So as we did at the time, you just say, oh, it's probably not a gunshot. But anyway, she said, yeah, we'll get someone down there. Everyone's putting their feet up, having a cup of tea. No one wants to go out. Anyway, about 2 minutes later, another call comes in. Yeah, so I'm sure I heard a gunshot. So right, okay. So my inspector at the time, I was driving him. So he said, right, Paige, we better go and investigate this. So I said, all right, sir. So I got the car around. We got in the car and we drove down to this sort of similar estate to this, like block of flats. And as we pull up, it's all in darkness. All the flats are in darkness because it's late. So we pull up, and as we go to approach the communal door, we notice to the left there's a broken window. And so I thought that was a bit odd. So we thought we'll go and knock on that door, because obviously someone's put their window. Maybe that's what it was. The noise was someone breaking the window. So we opened the communal door, knocked on this particular door, no answer. We could hear a muffled sound inside. What's that? You know, we could hear someone, sounded like someone rolling about, you know. And so anyway, as we bent down to look through the letterbox, we thought we heard something like a gun loading, being cocked. So we both ran out, both of us trying to push ourselves through the door at the same time, fighting each other to get through the door. We just legged it behind a police car. And so we called up on the radio, yeah, we need to find out who's in this flat and get a line put through and see if we can ring up. Anyway, no lines come through. And it subsequently transpired that there was a fella, he'd had a domestic with this girl, and he'd been locked up in Southend Police Station for a couple of days, I think it was. And he'd got out, gone to Tilbury, picked up a shotgun, gone round to the flat, gone in there with his girlfriend's in there with their young daughter, but her brother's there. He's beat up the brother and tied him up. And that was the muffling side. We could hear him rumbling about on the floor. And the broken window was in, he had a pump action, if it was a pump action shotgun, it was in blowing the window out. And then obviously the ch-ch we heard was in reloading and pointing the gun at us behind the door. And so the upshot of it was armed police turn up, you know, try and get through to this fella, you know, loud hailer, da 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 da. He's not having any of it. And in the end, he dragged the child and the girlfriend into this small toilet, put the gun under his chin and blew his head off.
Jesus.
And we went in there and secured the kid, the child and the girl. And there was just nothing left of it. He's just a headless corpse. The rest of it was stuck to the ceiling. He lost that much blood that when they did the autopsy, they found it difficult to get any decent specimens of blood out of him. She was only 8, I think, the child.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
So you could have been collateral damage in there.
But it makes you think, you know what I mean? It's not all about, it makes things like that make you think about your own life. And, you know, I could quite have easily at the time thought, you know what, stuff this, I'm off. But I didn't, I stayed with it. I'm not giving myself a pat on the back for that. I'm just saying that story there is what many police officers go through day in, day out, and worse. You know what I mean?
How common is domestic abuse and crimes of
Very
passion?
Very common. I mean, we used to deal with that. The pet hates for police officers are wife beaters, sex cases, and nonces, as in paedophiles. They're the pet hates, and they're the three areas really that you're going to get a clump, or you did back in the day. I mean, where I was at Essex or the Met, if we come across a wife beater, they'd be getting a clump. If you want to hit a woman, then know how it feels. It's as simple as that. If you want to touch a woman, a like sexiest sort of woman, then you're going to get a clump. If you want to touch a child, you're going to get more than just a clump. And that's what we did back in them days. That, you know, if was it corruption? Was it bent for the job? It was all of them things. But unfortunately, you've got police officers are human beings. You know, I'm not saying it was right at the time, but I was, well, it wasn't justified. But was it right morally? That's a different kettle of fish. That's open to debate. Whether or not a child sex offender, when he's caught, he's committed an offence, he gets a clump. Because I'll tell you one thing, he'll remember the clump more than he remembers the going to court and getting a slap on the wrist. You know what I mean?
One of my very first blog entries was about a guy who had tied up and tortured a sex offender in prison.
Mm.
And I asked the public, you know, what do you think of this? And 99% were for it.
Yeah. I mean, the problem it's in the book, I've fitted up sex offenders. Now I've beat them up, stitched them up and locked them up, you know. And to me, back in them days, you know, the trouble is you have people that are armchair critics, which is fine. We're all an even society, so everyone should have their fair share in saying. But unless you've looked into the eyes of a victim of child sex abuse or a woman who's been battered, you know, or a lady that's been walking along and been raped, and you look into their eyes and you have to take their statements and read, and then it has to be read out in court what's actually happened to them, you don't know what you're talking about. It's a different kettle of fish.
The podcast that made me cry when I was interviewing the person recently was Mike Tarriger. And he was a victim. Horrendous. Mm. He was rented out on the meat rack.
Yeah.
If you guys out there watching this video have not seen the testimony of a victim, hardcore abuse in the Kerr homes, got rented out as a kid. Mm. I'll put in the description box below this video, I'll put a link to that if you want to watch so you can understand exactly what Paul is saying here. So why did you move over to the Met?
Right, what happened with that was I knew people in the Met through karate, senior officers. I knew a chief superintendent, some inspectors and sergeants and some PCs. And there was a British police karate championships being held at Hendon. So I got time off. Well, I was actually on night duty, so I didn't get the time off. What happened was I went there during the day, ended up fighting, got into the finals, the grand finals, as it were, they called it, and I looked at my watch and thought, I'm not going to get back for night duty, so I'm going to have to go, leave the finals. But the assistant commissioner of the Met was there at the time, Sir Brian Hayes, and he was a black belt karate. He one of the organisers. So the Met people that I knew went up to him and said, look, Paul's meant to be in the finals, but he's got to go back on duty. So he rang the local borough commander and said, look, Paul, your officer's here, he's in the finals, can he stay? So they said, oh yeah, of course he can. But that's not what they told me during the day. They said, you better be on duty, mate. Oh, but if it's all right when an assistant commissioner rings up and says, can he stay? It's all right then, isn't it? So that's how I got in, got to meet him. And he said to me, oh, you should come over to the Met. And I was thinking at the time, you know, the money's better. I knew people in there. And so I transferred over. Ended up at Marylebone Police Station.
That's quite busy, Central London. Is it?
It was. I mean, it's been knocked down now, sadly. The actual police station's been knocked down. They're building flats on it. But it was a busy, nick. You know, there was lots to do there.
Were there a new set of challenges there because you're in a city and instead of more on the outskirts?
Yeah. I mean, like I said to you before, there's new set of challenges is you, in Essex, you was a name. People knew you were by name, you know, whatever nick you went to, everyone knew you because it's a smaller environment. The Met, you're a number. You're not so many officers know who you are, really, from other nicks, because there's so many of you. And the dangers of that is you don't know who to trust and who you can trust.
Mm.
Whereas when you're in Essex, you knew everyone. And if there was a, pardon the expression, if there was a snitch amongst you, everyone knew who it was. And they'd get terrorised and they'd be gone. Whereas in the Met, you don't know who you're working with, what they're like. And as I said to you before, immediately became apparent to me that there was officers there that really didn't have a clue how to deal with the public. You know what I mean? You know, they would start a fight literally for no reason. And that's not what I was about. You know, I came from a multicultural environment. I'm from the East End of London. Lots of friends, black, Asian, Greek, Turkish. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying I witnessed a racism because there was a lot of black officers where I worked. But what I'm saying is you should understand people when you're dealing with them, their cultures and how to talk to people. You know, you had some officers that I met who just were incapable of understanding a person's culture or understanding, you know, where a person's coming from, if you know what I mean. And that would cause friction and that from friction would cause issues and arguments and then from that would cause a fight. So inexperienced people, I would say, we're a lot, you know, we're in the Met. And then I understood why you sort of, obviously there's more officers in the Met, but they did have a bad reputation at the time when I went over there. I'm not saying I made it any better, but you know, it did open my eyes to think, you know what, I've got to watch my back here, because there's too many people that can get you in the shit.
And on the streets of London, is there a lot more crime? A
lot more crime, a lot more danger. Found myself fighting a lot more, not through want of fighting. I mean, what I'm saying is, if you was that type of officer, you could have a fight every day of the week. But it's not about fighting at the end of the day. It's about keeping the streets safe. It was at the time, you know, and getting the right people. And you could end up literally walking down the road and coming across a robbery some days every hour, because what you had was a mix of poor people living with rich people. Listen, Green Estate, you had sort of a poor estate there, but then 5 minutes down the road, you've got St. John's Wood, multi-million pound houses, Rolls Royces, Mercedes. So obviously you had a lot of issues with robberies, street robberies around there, drugs, a lot of drugs. And so, yeah, it was certainly a busy place to be.
You mentioned you had an encounter with a corpse that he'd blown his head off with the shotgun. Mm. Did you come across corpses at the Met?
I dealt with a couple of sudden deaths. Nothing really is. I mean, I dealt with some gory stuff in Essex, which I haven't. Oh, obviously, I've told you a few things, but in the Met, I dealt with a murder actually. Just before I went to Royal Protection Department, it was a murder of a transvestite prostitute. It's only a young person, but the call was, I was driving the area car at the time, and I get called that we've got a fatal stabbing at an address. I think it was near Foley Street. I don't know if you know the Langham Hotel. It's on Regent Street, and opposite that is the BBC Radio 1 building. It's a pretty big iconic building. It's where they do all the Radio 1 stuff. Well, anyway, this particular address where this stabbing had taken place was about 2-3 minutes walk from this Radio 1 place. And so we go there, emergency call, go there, enter the premises. It's a ground floor, first floor flat. And there's a person, well, we thought was it long hair and a pair of red knickers on, but it was a mess. It'd been stabbed, violently murdered. There was handprints all up the wall. So it was a proper, there's obviously a fight or trying to, you know, save himself. And we thought it was a female at the time. And then the maid came in, because it was a prostitute, had a maid that looked after the bookings or whatever, and said, no, it's a male transvestite. So I said, right, okay. And then she said, oh, he's got AIDS. So obviously at that time, back in 20 odd years ago, we just split. Once we'd made sure this area was secure and there was nobody inside, secured the scene. And what had happened is, so we did the log. So the murder investigation team turned up to take over. And so we went. And then about a month later, I was on a firearms course. And then I got on rotary and I was doing my firearms course. I was at Lippitt's Hill. And I bumped into a detective inspector who was going on protection as well. And we got chatting. And I was saying to him, oh, I was at Marylebone. He said, oh, was you at Marylebone? I said, yeah. I said, I dealt with a murder just before I come up. He said, oh, so did I. He goes, I was in charge of the murder. I said, was it that prostitute? He went, yeah. He goes, oh, with that, it was a funny one. Basically, what had happened is, villains had heard that she'd got an appointments book with famous names in it. And so they had gone round there to get the book so they could blackmail people from the appointments book. And obviously the victim didn't want to give the book up, and hence why he was savagely stabbed and killed. Anyway, I'm going to tell as much as I can, but I'm not going to drop the person in it because it's not fair. You know what I mean? It's not. But what I'm trying to say is, if you work for BBC Current Affairs, don't throw fucking stones in greenhouses. Do you know what I mean? So anyway, this detective says. We found the book. Anyway, one of the names in it was a prominent radio presenter at the time, and he was a big person on telly. And his name was in the book. So the detective went round and made arrangements to go and visit him, went to the offices, and he was sitting there with a solicitor already. So the detective said to him, do you know the victim, whatever the person's name was? He said, no, never met him in life. I said, right, okay. So is your fingerprints going to be in this flat? anywhere in this flat. And then the person, the suspect at the time, because everyone's a suspect. If your name's in an appointment book, you're a suspect. Says, I don't know. I think a friend of mine used to live in the flat. So my prints might be in there. You know, so obviously he wasn't coughing to the fact. He didn't know why his name was in the book, da da da, all this tosh. And so anyway, in the end, my friend, the detective, said, so I just want to let you know that this person also had AIDS or HIV. He said, and this celebrity's like went pale white and nearly burst into tears. And they left him at that. But yeah, it was his name was in the book amongst others.
I interviewed John Wedger, who worked at London Met, and then when he was working in Vice, everything was going well until he tracked some of the customers were politicians and celebrities, and then orders would come down from the top to shut the investigations down. Does that happen in the police?
It can do in certain circumstances. I mean, in that particular case, the investigation team, they actually arrested someone and it was convicted for murder on that particular case. And then it all came out about the book and what they wanted and to do the blackmail. But investigations, depending on how important they are to the general public in terms of public decency awareness and if it's a public figure. Obviously, the Met Police, along with most other police forces, will look at a case and say, is it in the public interest that these people are arrested for whatever it is? I don't know. I mean, so you could have cross investigations, which happens, so for example, you could have a team investigating a certain person, but they come across another team from a different, like the NCA might be investigating them. So they get told to drop the investigation because another investigation that crosses it is more important, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So the impression that you get is they've been told to drop their investigation, but they haven't been told why, because they want to retain secrecy of the first investigation, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So you'll get people say, oh, we were doing the investigation, but we were told to drop it. Yeah, but you were told to drop it maybe because they were looking at that person or someone else connected to that person, and they didn't want to overlap it because this case takes priority. So that's one explanation that could happen, where you get two different teams because they don't all communicate. You'll get officers from another force may come across a drugs operation in the Met and they don't realise, and then it intertangles and they say, well, look, that happened in my case. In my case, when they were looking at me, what police force was it now? Another police force were looking into me and the Met came across and said, no, we're dealing with this. So they take the investigation. Do you see what I mean? And they do that all the time. I mean, they can be shut down, yeah. I mean,
well, the classic example then, Prince Charles had this really strong relationship with Jimmy Savile. I read Princess Di's book in her own words, and she said she thought Savile was creepy. The royals brought him in to give marriage guidance to them. And there were reports given to the police over the years about Savile's activity, but it never came out until after he died. Do you think that there was a conspiracy to keep that concealed until after his death? Because he had these powerful relationships like what Prince Andrew had with Epstein.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a chance that if there's sensitive information appertaining to a senior politician or a member of the royal family, that is withheld or it's pushed under, because obviously, again, it all comes back to the threshold. Is it in the public interest? That's what they use, public interest. And then you've got PII, public interest immunity, which is what if they don't want to give information out, they'll hide behind that. There's a lot of different things they can do. Covering up criminal offences, I would say back in the 70s and 80s, that was clear that when you look now at the sex scandals that are going on with paedophiles, it was clear that those things did happen.
I'm just watching the Profumo Affair documentary. It's on the BBC. Part 3 was on last night. And that shows how things are covered up. Yeah.
Yeah. So you cannot, you've always got to have an open mind. When you listen to things about investigations that should have occurred, that didn't occur, you know, and certainly when you look at Savile and a lot of BBC, there was a lot of leeway afforded these people. It's clear. It's obvious. But times have changed in terms of the way the public perception is. And like I said, in the police service back in the end days when I was 25 years ago, you could get away with a lot more than what you could get away with there. So like now, it's the same with sex crimes. It's more, the investigations are a lot tighter, although we're still getting fuck-ups now. Look at Carl Beach and what happened there, you know. But that's not to say part of those investigations are still should not be stopped, because there are, obviously, there's politicians that have done wrong.
Was Savile entering the palace under your watch? Was that a different era?
I remember him coming a couple of times when I was there. And to be fair, he was quite fun. He was quite a funny person. He was quite amenable. So when you look at him, if you saw him walking down the street, you think that's a sex case, wouldn't you? You know, in a shiny tracksuit, in a little tiny shorts, you'd think he looks like a nonce. You'd see it now,
but back then, we all grew up on Savile, didn't we? We all thought he was funny, a caricature.
You see him, you know, but he was quite funny, and we all liked him, to be fair. You didn't think he was a creepy character, but then that's the facade, isn't it? A lot of paedophiles are the very same. They've got a split personality, and for no one would have believed about Savile, and this is a problem a lot of their victims had. When they were piping up, who was really going to believe them against, you know, Sir Jimmy? Not many. They were probably classed as like cranks, but they were actually telling the truth.
Did you actually have any conversations with Savile?
Only when he came into the palace a couple of times. He came in.
Does he come in his own car? Yeah, or?
No, he came up in a tracksuit. He came up in a tracksuit to see. I can't remember who's coming in to see now, but he would have a laugh and a giggle with us at the gate, and we'd let him in. Yeah, he'd walk in a tracksuit.
Wow.
Yeah, he didn't, you know, the two times I saw him, he had casual clothes on. Like I said, the best time was when he had the shell suit on and he was coming in. The thing with celebrities as well, I don't know if you've noticed that not many people have piped up to challenge Prince Andrew's behaviour, as in like none. I've not seen it. I think Piers Morgan might have said, you know, he's a disgrace or whatever. But there's not many celebrities that have actually condemned Prince Andrew's activities, or certainly his interview, you know, where he's basically disrespected survivors of child sex abuse.
And what's your interpretation of celebrities not?
Because I've seen so many of them go through them palace doors. Who really wants to be out of favour with the royal family? And this is the issue you've got in public with celebrities. Who wants to be out of favour with the royal family? Because the royal family are literally linked with every charity. So, and I've said in my Twitter, I said, what child protection agency or charity has actually stood up and said Prince Andrew's a disgrace? None. Because Prince Charles will be a patron, or Princess Anne will be a patron. So that they're all interconnected. So my issue is, you know, with the Epstein scandal and Prince Andrew, the bigger picture is child sex abuse. You know, all he's done is, you know, I personally don't think anything's going to happen to Prince Andrew. I've said it all along. There's no evidence that I can see that's going to come to light, that's going to put him in the frame. Virginia Roberts has made allegations, but those allegations have gone nowhere. The FBI, if they've liaised with the British government, which they would have done, would have most certainly decided that they're not going to. Because if you think about Prince Andrew going to court, that's just an impossibility in my eyes. No, given where I worked and what I know and how the system works, I can't see him being convicted of any criminal offence or being indicted for one.
So Prince Andrew, I've read all of the victim's statements, and there are serious allegations from Virginia. One of the victims said he grabbed a breast of a puppet on his hand.
Yeah.
Virginia said that he was in an orgy with underage girls. So there's massive public pressure on the FBI to do something about this. Yeah. Supposedly, because we've got these stories in the tabloids and in the news, and we don't know what's real, what's not real. Supposedly, Virginia is the target of an FBI investigation right now, but Prince Andrew is not. But the lawyers of the victims are requesting that they speak to him. And if he touches down on American soil, he's going to get subpoenaed into court, and all this stuff is going to, all this legal stuff is going to get thrown at him.
I mean, what I'd say is, and this is potentially a key, right, to the fact that he's not going to be subject to any subpoenas or any indictments, is because if you're involved in an investigation, or you're being investigated, you're knowingly being investigated, would you go on telly and talk about it, knowing that you could be potentially indicted. You wouldn't, unless you knew that you weren't. The reason being is you keep your mouth shut until the investigation is over and done with. You don't go on telly and give an explanation, because all you're doing is you're giving information to the opposing team that they can then use against you when they actually do decide to arrest you and say, well, you said this and this isn't correct. Because that interview he gave, I pulled it apart myself. All right. And for him to have been with legal advisors, he would have had a legal team around him. And they would have, albeit he, if they thought there was a possibility of any indictments coming his way, they'd have shut the idea of him doing the interview down. So he must have had some guarantees that this isn't going anywhere for him to publicly speak.
Yeah, I came to a conclusion only recently that he went into that interview knowing he has absolute immunity. Exactly. That he would never spend a day in prison in his life. And he could say absolutely anything. It doesn't matter.
But that's the whole point. And people need to understand that they're saying, oh, he might get indicted. He's not going to get indicted for anything. If there was a chance of any lawyer worth his weight in gold would tell his client, keep your mouth shut, keep your head down, because potentially there's an investigation that you may be involved in. But obviously he's been given a guarantee from whoever that, you know, that nothing's going to happen with this. The evidence must have been poured over and poured over. The FBI aren't saying anything, but it's like anything with a police investigation. The majority of the times, they know in the first 24 hours what the situation is, and then the rest is evidence gathering to confirm what the original suspicions were. So whatever Virginia Roberts has said, it's still not made enough of an impact to stop Prince Andrew. Because he says he's come out and had to give an explanation. Well, if there's a criminal inquiry and potentially you're a suspect, it doesn't matter. You keep your mouth shut until there's a court case. Then your lawyers will put forward a story.
Yeah, first thing your lawyer says, plead the fifth.
Yeah.
Ask for a lawyer. Don't speak to the media.
Yeah. You know, and what they do is, I mean, the palace have got a press office and they deal with all the communications. So what happens every day is the press clippings from that day will come to the palace and they will be given to the Queen. And what that is the press officer will look for them and say, if there's any shitty stories about the members of the royal family or whatever it is, obviously they will brief the Queen. But usually what will happen is newspapers will come to the press office and say, look, we've got this story. And they will try and the press office will try and do a deal to deflect the story. And say, look, if you forget that story, we'll give you a nice story of, I don't know, Prince Edward's going to visit some charity and you will give you the exclusive or something. Do you know what I mean? Just to dumb it down. So there is a trade-off between newspapers and the press office. So let's get it right now that the press don't always give you the full picture, right? Sometimes there's a trade-off and they agree to not give the full story out. You know what I mean? And so when you hear, for example, I'll quickly say this, when you hear a spokesman said or a close friend said, no, there is no close friend. That's the press office putting out a narrative out there for you to soak up.
So did you see the reporter who was on the hot mic who didn't know she was getting recorded? Mm. And she said, I had this Epstein story years ago.
Yeah, from ABC.
We had Clinton, yeah. We had everybody. But, you know, but the royal family got wind. Yeah. They were going to cut us off. They weren't going to give us a story about...
Yeah, but that's what I've just said to you. It's blackmail. It's blackmail, and that is how it works. You know, there's a trade-off. But what's happened now is because this story has sort of gathered pace, their sort of trade-offs aren't really worth much now. But I think the most important thing to remember with Prince Andrew is that everything he said in that interview, or a lot of it, was just rubbish, complete rubbish.
What is your analysis of the interview?
Right. First and foremost, he was lying. And I detailed this in the interview I gave with Ian in relation to the travel arrangements and the Pizza Express story. Well, if that was a genuine sort of visit he was going on with his daughter, which is another member of the royal family, so you've got at least two, maybe three members of the royal family, you don't just turn up to Pizza Hut and queue up, or Pizza Express and queue up in the queue, do you? What would have happened is he'd have had a protection officer would have gone down there, who would have booked the tables, they would have been cordoned off, and then that would have been ready to go. So he'd have been out the car, straight to the booth, not standing in the queue. So that was a pre-planned situation. Therefore, it would have all been notes would have been made. They would have done checks. They would have spoken to the manager of the Pizza Express and saying, listen, we're bringing a principal down here. So that everyone would have known what the situation was. And purely and simply, it would have been all cordoned off, and an officer may well have been there awaiting arrival just in case there was some rowdy people turn up, and then they would have called up and said, it's not a good, you know, it's not a good place to be, drive off.
It was quite quiet when we went there, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And to people watching this, we have filmed at Pete's Express Woking, and we have talked to the staff there. If you want to watch that video, click down in the description box below this video, and there's an Epstein playlist. The link will be down there. And Paul referenced what he did with Ian. Let me just expand on that. Paul did a YouTube video with Ian Puddick, who has his own YouTube channel. I'm going to put the link to that clip also in the description box below this video if you want to go down and click over and watch that on Ian Puddick's channel as well. So, okay, so what else did you find?
So just on that, to be clear, yeah. So there would have been documentary evidence, and I said it was quoted from me in the newspapers, the national papers, just after this interview, that what would have happened is there would have been a record of that visit, officers entry, the notebooks, maybe a security assessment they would have done on that, because it was an actual visit. And as I explained, the reasons why they would have done that. But those notes would be kept between 6 and 30 years. So there's potentially a chance that there would have been notes that would have corroborated Prince Andrew's story. But then that doesn't mean to say he wasn't in Tramp's nightclub 4 hours later.
We noticed that Pete's, we looked at the sign on the door in Pete's Express Woking. It closes at 10:30 p.m.
Yeah.
What time do you think Tramp's nightclub opens at?
10:30.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's the issue you've got there is, look, again, coming back to the officer's notes, even if the FBI request information from the Royal Protection Command, they would get a big fat no. They're not going to get any documentation from the British police whatsoever in relation to Prince Andrew's movements or anything else. But to me, the issue would be that where they would have documentation is the Epstein visit. Because when a member of the royal family, and I said this previously, any member of the royal family, if they're going to go abroad, they don't just jump on a plane and go. It has to be assessed. There's an office within the Royal Protection Department that deals with all the foreign travel and the assessments and the liaisons with the foreign police forces and all the rest of it. As you can imagine, it's not a small operation. So if a member, is such as Prince Andrew, because he's like one of the main members of the royal family, is going abroad, what would happen is it would all be pre-planned. So the Royal Protection Command would contact the local police force, which would have been the New York police, I should imagine. But also, they've probably got government protection. I think they have government protection officers because I'm sure they were with Prince Andrew on the Epstein visit. It's subsequently transpired. So what would happen is we would give them the address of where Prince Andrew was staying when we're coming, you know, the team's coming. They would do the necessary checks on the premises and the people within those premises. So they would check the freehold to see who owns it to make sure it's not, I don't know, a gangster or, you know, whatever else. And in this case, it was Mr. Epstein. So obviously they would have checked out Mr. Epstein's details had Andrew given them. If he hadn't, his details would have still come up on the freehold for the property. So obviously they would have checked out Mr. Epstein in their police computer and it would have come up that he was a convicted child sex offender. So the security stroke threat assessment that the Americans would have done and passed back to us would have noted all that in there, would have said that this is not a suitable address for a member of the British royal family to stay at for the reasons listed. And obviously they would have explained Epstein and whatever else, the convictions. So that information would have then been passed to Prince Andrew directly through his personal protection officer, or it could have been done through the commander. And they would have basically said, we advise you not to go. To stay with this gentleman in these premises. So when I talk about paperwork trail, you've had emails back and forth. May have even had written letters back and forth, but you certainly would have had emails from the Americans back to us with their advice. And then there probably would have been a security meeting with Royal Protection. What I mean by that is the commander would have sat down with the officers, protection officers, and said, right, this is the report. This is what we've got. We've analysed it. We need to advise Purple 41, which is Prince Andrew's code name, against visiting this person. That would have been done. Anyone who says that would not have been done is lying or don't know anything about security. So that information would have been passed to Prince Andrew. So Prince Andrew would have said, no, I'm going, and refused to listen to the advice given. That would have been noted on the notes by the Royal Protection Command that he refused. Well, why did you refuse when you was told clearly? Because he, for some reason, he felt the need to go over, and in his own words, which was just rubbish, 4 days to say goodbye to someone. You know, I'll be quite frank there. If that was anyone else, a normal person, yeah, and they found out their a friend of theirs was a convicted child sex offender, you'd ring them up, say, delete my number and fuck right off and put the phone down, wouldn't you? It's exactly. As simple as that. That is the sum total of the conversation you would have. But obviously, Prince Andrew spent 4 days apparently saying goodbye. Now, the problem he's got as well is to say that he did it out of respect or whatever to go over there. Well, what
he was
about,
so honourable.
That was it. Did the honourable thing. Well, I'm sorry. What you just did there was trashed every survivor of child sex trafficking, child sex exploitation, and, you know, any survivor of child sex abuse. You've dismissed their feelings and what they've gone through in one fell swoop, which gives you an indication as to what his mind, which is important now, his mindset, how he ticks, how he thinks, because now you know that he's very careless and he doesn't understand about human life. So that shows you that he doesn't care, you know, which is a big sign. It's a big sign, you know what I mean?
On that point then, you know, if he'd have got up on an interview and said, well, everywhere I go is logged and I can produce the logs of where I was that day, this is, you know, my best evidence. But he wouldn't say that because that would basically end up with his own crucifixion.
Yeah, but also don't forget his protection officers, because I know they dragged one of them up and they went and found him. And he said, oh, I can't remember what I was doing 20 odd years ago, which to be fair to him, he probably wouldn't. But the other issue would be if any of his protection officers had seen anything untoward and turned a blind eye, well, by opening their mouths now, they're incriminating themselves in potentially a criminal investigation, you know, a crime. So, of course, now they're not going to say, even if they did see anything, they're not going to say they did now. They're not going to be immune from prosecution, you know. So you've got that side of the coin as well, that whatever notes were taken by officers, or even if there was a concern, say if officers were with Prince Andrew and they thought this is not right, and they would have contacted the commander, it would have been a call back to base and said, look, this is the situation, what do we do? Unless it's he's a physically attacking someone, or they've, you know, he's raping someone, they're not going to be in the same room in terms of watching all this go down. Do you know what I mean? But if they've got a suspicion, then they would have had to get advice from back home, from the commander. And so there's a chain of command, and all those, that chain of command potentially could be incriminated in something what Prince Andrew's done. So why then would the Royal Protection Command give up any information that could incriminate a number of officers?
So we're aware of this one criminal situation. From your experience, would you say that Prince Andrew was the type of person who would override his security advice and get in other situations?
Yeah, I mean, this is the whole point about, I think, what happened with what I said 10 years ago. The point I was trying to make 10 years ago, that it's not just police officers who abuse their position of trust or their position of authority, it's also members of the royal family. And the incidents that I described in relation to Prince Andrew have come back basically to bite him on the backside, because if you, for example, and I've said this, if we go back to basics, so Buckingham Palace is one of the most protected buildings in the country, right? I know there's people that have said previously, oh yeah, what about Fagan? That was 40 years ago, right? What they need to understand is the level of protection that is, you know, contained within the palace now is a lot different than it was 40 odd years ago. You know, you've got pressure beams, you've got, I'm not going to go through all the details, but you've got sensors in the ground, you've got beams going across, you know, the forecourts, you've got pressure pads on railings, you've got Israeli wire, which is alarmed. So the point being, if someone did breach the outer perimeter, they would be tracked within a feet of every step where they went. And the reaction, what would happen is you've got armed officers on the various number of posts, all heavily armed. And there would be a quick reaction force, if you want to call it that, that has already been waiting to go. So you'd have the officers on post, but then you'd have another team that would come out, would be deployed to go to that area. All right. And you'd then have a helicopter would be there within seconds. You'd have dog fans. It would be a total lockdown. So when people dismiss, when I say, oh, the palace is secure, and they say, well, people got in. No, Fagin got in, that's right. But after that, the security is ramped up to a point where it's literally impossible to penetrate the inner part of the palace. So you've got all that security, multi-million pounds worth of technology and equipment. You've got police officers, and we're there to do one thing, to stop people that shouldn't be coming into the palace getting in. That's the sole reason, and protecting those within it.
Some people might not be aware of the Fagin situation. Could you just clarify
Michael
what that
Fagin was? Michael Fagin was a gentleman of about, must have been about 40 years ago now, who breached the palace, got climbed over the wall and actually got into the Queen's bedroom. I mean, that was to get, that was just the stroke of luck to get into her bedroom. But without going, without breaching security and getting myself in trouble, I can understand how he did it from where he got in and going along the certain where he was, and the Queen would leave her window open at certain times. So, you know, the problem you've got is you've got officers outside her bedroom door, but obviously not contained within her apartment. But there are officers at posted at underneath her bedroom window. So it's a lot different, as I say, than what it was back then when Fagin actually got in and sat on the Queen's bed and had a conversation with her. That would not happen today. But they've obviously they've had breaches of security before. We've had Fathers of Justice get over the fence, but obviously not penetrate the interior of the palace, just get over the fence and climb along the colonnade, which is totally different than actually having a suspect get into the palace. So to actually get in, like I said, there's a series of ways. You've got to be invited, obviously, to get in unless you work there. Then you're backwards and forwards. But there's a certain set protocol to get into the palace. And same with sort of Houses of Parliament and stuff like that. And that is, there's a post. If you look at the front of the palace, you've got a security post there and you'll see policemen standing there. And that's called the 1-1 post. So that's the first point of call for a visitor. There is another entrance point around the side, which is called the side door. And that's usually for tradesmen. You know, we call it the numpty entrance because it's the likes of me and you would be going through there, wouldn't it? We wouldn't be going through the front of the palace, would we? Let's be honest. Right? So you would come up and present yourself to the officers on that post. Now, what happens is first thing in the morning, there's another security post inside the palace at the front with police officers in it. And they get all the appointments for all the members of the royal family sent down to them. And they write it in their book. So in the morning at 9 o'clock, they ring those appointments through to the officers on the gate. They then write it in their book, so they know exactly who's coming and at what time and who they're going to see. Obviously, it makes sense. So John Smith would turn up, say, at 10 o'clock and say, I'm here to see the Queen. We get a lot of people turning up to say they're here to see the Queen. Not necessarily all of them are invited. So we check the book. Yeah, John Smith's in the book. So then you ring through to the neck to the privy purse, confirm the appointment. They say yes. Then you allow him to go into the palace.
Whereas, what does the privy purse mean?
It's an old-fashioned office which deals with all the appointments, I'm guessing. I mean, I wasn't a royal, I'll be honest with you, I was an East End copper and I went to royalty for my own reasons. I wasn't a royal lover as such. It was a lot of money. You earned a lot of money up there for doing very little. But I wasn't interested in the palace regalia, or I did my job to the best of my ability, but I wasn't sort of interested in all the flash names. I just knew privy purse because that's where all the appointments come down from. And so basically, so you get through to the privy purse, then they show you to the principal who you're there to see. So there's a set procedure. You can't just walk into the palace. There can't be any mistakes made. And all the members of the royal family understand that they have to provide the names of the visitors. Only one who never did, was Prince Andrew. So that protocol was not followed by him and him alone. So Prince Andrew, Prince Edward, Princess Anne, Prince Philip, Queen's husband, the Queen, all those members of the royal family, even though some didn't live at the palace, would have appointments there, would all still follow the same procedure with Prince Andrew. And it happened a lot with young women. We were not told their names. We were told not to ask the names. They would present themselves at the palace. They're here to see Prince Andrew, and we would just have to let them in, which was a clear breach of the security protocol. And that security protocol was put in place in order to stop people getting into the palace who shouldn't be in there. So we complained about this on a number of occasions and were told it is what it is. You know, it's his ass, and if he wants to do that, then he can do that. Yeah, so we've gone through the fact that he was the only member of the royal family to breach the security protocol when it comes to guests entering the palace. Now, my experience, this is, as again, it's all my personal experience that I'm telling you now. And for the doubters out there that say, oh, how can we trust this officer? He's been to prison. Well, it's quite simple that has anyone challenged me publicly about what I've said since I said it 10 years ago? No one. I was with police officers, serving officers, when all these incidents occurred. Has any of these officers who are my friends, have any of them come forward and denied what I've said? No, because they won't, because it's the truth. So everything that I'm saying there is 100% what I saw and what I heard, nothing more, nothing less. So Prince Andrew, his main sort of problem was with us was the amount of females that would enter the palace and not follow security procedure. And as I said to you, that is an issue for the reason of outline, because you do get people coming up to the front of the palace and saying, I'm here for the Duke. I mean, and they're actually quite mad, and they're not. So how do we know one time a person's come up and says, I'm here for Prince Andrew, but they're not really there, and we just let them in? Who's going to end up walking the beat in Brixton? It's going to be me. But that's what we had to live with. That's the type of man he was, because whenever it went wrong, for example, I remember one occasion a female turned up at the front of the palace. There was three of us on duty at this time. And she said, oh, I'm here for Prince Andrew. It was probably about, it just come in about an hour previously, just whizzed in his Jag. But I think it was about 9 o'clock. So there was no privy purse. There was no office staff, because after 5 o'clock, the office staff go home. So there's no privy purse. It's just us and then letting them through into what is known as the quad, which is a quadrangle within the centre of the palace. And contained within that is the Queen's door, the Duke of Edinburgh's door, and Prince Andrew's got his own door. So there's different entrances for different members of the royal family. So on this particular occasion, the young female approaches us and says she's here to visit Prince Andrew. Well, we didn't have anything in the book, because we don't put anything in the book because it's Prince Andrew. We've not got a name, so we can't ring anyone to confirm it. We couldn't get hold of his footman, which would usually do, and say, look, this is one of the non-entry, one of these guests that we're not putting in the book. Is she expected? Well, we couldn't get hold of him, so we couldn't confirm at this time. So rather than let this person in, we dared to say, look, sorry, we can't let you in. So she said, oh, well, I'll tell you what, I'll ring him on his mobile. So she proceeded to ring Prince Andrew, who was in, because his apartments faced the front of the palace, so he clearly could look down and see us. And so she just said to him, oh, it's Andrew, it's me. The officers won't let me in because I'm not expected, apparently. So we could hear him on the phone. He said, put one of the officers on the phone. So my colleague picked the phone up and he basically said to him, listen to me, you fat lardy ass cunt. Let my guest in now, I'll come down there immediately. And so we all heard it. Even the female guest went bright red. So my colleague, and unfortunately, he was quite a plump boy. So he's obviously looking out the window, could see that it was my colleague who was a bit plump. That's why he's called him fat. He's giving the phone back to the female. We've just let her go. Just let her go straight into the palace.
So when he's on the BBC interview and he's talking about, you know, I am a polite person, honourable, yeah. I speak in terms of manner, unbecoming.
No.
The incident you've just described, was that perhaps he was just enraged at that one situation? It might have been an extrapolation, or was he generally like that? Have you got other examples? Your tie's twisted. Well, there you go.
If I thought it was just one example, I probably wouldn't have mentioned it, because I've probably given the benefit of that. But unfortunately, it's not the only time he's ever been rude. I mean, another occasion, we were in the police lodge and we get a call that there's a unidentified person on the Queen's corridor, albeit the Queen was not in residence at this time, but the security cameras couldn't work out who it was wandering up and down. So obviously they sent myself and two PCs and a sergeant to go and investigate, to just ascertain who it was. Two of us went one way around the corridor and two of us went the other way in order to come either end of them. And as we got closer, it was Prince Andrew, just dressed scruffily. And the sergeant approached him and said, I'm really sorry, Your Highness. We got called because no one could recognise who it was on camera, and we were just coming to make sure that it was an intruder. And he said, listen to me, you. This is my house and I'll go where I want. Now, fuck off. You know, and you know, he's saying that to his four police officers. We've come there to do a job, but you know, to we're there for his protection and the protection of the royal family, and we're there because we've seen a potential intruder.
And his life depends on that. You think he would cherish?
I mean, unfortunately, that's the attitude that he had, and he was just a rude and abusive, obnoxious person.
Now, talking about dressing scruffily, just to divert real quick. In the BBC interview, Andrew said he never goes out in casual clothes in London.
I said this previously. He's talking rubbish. He used to sometimes come back in a shirt and chinos, a shirt without a tie, with like a golfing, like a Pringle type jumper on. He would come back casually dressed on quite a few occasions. He would only go out dressed in shirt and tie if it's sort of an official engagement. But a lot of the times I'd see him in like a polo t-shirt and what have you. So I don't know why he even went down that road.
So these young women that are slipping in and out, some people have said, and it's a minority of people, and they have said, well, Virginia Roberts was 17. A man having sex with a 17-year-old in the UK is not a crime. Mm. And the women slipping in and out, could you determine roughly what age we're talking here?
Yeah, they were in their 20s. There wasn't any that I would say were younger than that. They were definitely in their 20s. And they were definitely some of them were 15, 20 years younger than Prince Andrew. It's obviously, it's not just my opinion, it's the opinion of other officers that I work with, that he obviously had a taste for younger women. And, you know, that's fine. But there was never an occasion, and I can honestly say that I ever had suspicions about the age of a female guest entering the palace.
And there's a situation in the book where the protection squad think that there's some prostitutes coming in.
Yeah, that's the Chelsea Herber girls. Yeah, basically what happened on that was, it was late, it was about 10 o'clock, maybe even later than that, I can't remember. And we just get a call, there's a taxi coming with two female guests for Prince Andrew, same protocol, just open the gates and let the taxi straight through into the quad. So we had to go and open the gates of the quad, because they're shut at night for security. So open the gates, taxi pulls up, there's two scantily clad females. I emphasise the word scantily clad. They had short skirts, very low cut tops, heavy makeup, and they were drinking cans of Coke, giggling and laughing. Now, the reason I'm picking up on that is because they're coming to see a member of the royal family, as opposed to going to a nightclub, which is a slightly different sort of, place you would go when you're dressed in that sort of attire. So it just seemed out of place for us. And my colleague, he was of the opinion that it was late, it was the night, and we're police officers, we have a laugh and a giggle, you know, and his opinion was they were prostitutes and they looked like prostitutes, or they looked like, he started off with they looked like prostitutes from the Chelsea Harbour Club, because apparently there's a high class escort agency running around that area called Chelsea Harbour Girls or something like that. Anyway, so he proceeds to get on the post phone and ring all the other police officers, because that's what they used to do on night duty, have a laugh. And he said, oh, there's a couple of girls coming in who look like prostitutes. Well, by the time it had gone round to the last person, they were now prostitutes. And so everyone wanted to get a look at them. And so the control room were told, as soon as they, because we had everything on camera, so we could see when they went in his apartment. So they were told, as soon as they exit the apartment, radio up and let everyone know so we can come down, and because there's only one way they were going to exit on this occasion, that's through the side door. So just let us know and we'll all come down and have a look. So but an hour, literally an hour, it was an hour. The control radio up and said, yeah, the guests are leaving 4-1's apartment now, en route down to the side door. So the side door is like another office, like I said to you, the numpty entrance, right? And it's got like a glass, there's a glass like airlock, as it were, that once you go into it, you've got to shut one glass door, come through the next one, then you're into the sort of the office area. So there was about 10 of us stood in there, like 10 coppers all stood there waiting for these two now prostitutes to come through the door. Anyway, as they come through the door, what the idiot in the control room didn't tell us was that Prince Andrew was coming with them. So as they've come through the glass airlock and everyone's looking gleefully at them to get an eyeful, a hand's grabbed the door and he's come through and stood in the airlock with them. So obviously, the next thing you know, there's about 10 coppers trying to run out of this little door all at the same time, falling out into the car park. You've got policemen crawling on their hands and knees, hiding behind parked cars, hiding in bushes. And he's literally walked him out. And there's two officers on the side gate there. He's walked him out onto the road. So he's now outside the palace grounds on his own with these two families. He waited there until a taxi came along and hailed him a taxi. Now, the point about that is, as fun as it was, the point about that was Prince Andrew has never, ever, nor to my mind, any member of the royal family has ever gone outside with a guest and hailed their own taxi. So what I, on this occasion, did he feel it necessary? Because usually, and I've said it before and it's been publicised, he may well get his protection officers to drive these females home, which again, we're not a fucking taxi service, pardon my French, but this is part of what would happen. Some protection officers would have to drive these females home, you know, and that's clearly not their duty. And also, other occasions, he would have taxis already waiting for the guests. So why on this occasion was there no taxi waiting for him? And I'm not trying to feed in a conspiracy theory. I'm just saying from my point of view and the rest of the officers' point of views, he just made himself look more suspicious on that occasion because he's now standing out on the road at near enough midnight hailing a taxi. You know.
So another objection you said you had with Prince Andrew's interview was he said he was so honourable and brave in the Falklands and he got fired at, and because of that he wasn't sweating at that time.
Yeah, well, that's rubbish because I've seen him sweating, and again, I've documented it and I've spoke about this, that he would come out in the garden and play golf, hit his golf balls up the garden, which on one occasion, it was an occasion where I needed to be on the phone and I couldn't because he'd come out the garden entrance and was now with his protection officer who was carrying his golf bag, which I had a particular issue with that because I thought, you're not a fucking caddy, you're a police officer. What are you doing? But this is what I'm trying to explain to you. He had that sort of, you know, purpose about him that if he's asking the protection officer to pick his golf bag up, he's going to do it. Because he's, you know, otherwise he'd be off the protection squad probably. And so Prince Andrew was playing, it was a really hot day on that day, and he was whacking golf balls up the end of the garden. He was sweating profusely. You know, and the reason I noticed that, because I wanted him to go back inside because I needed to use the post phone urgently, because at the time I was trading on the stock market, and that's the problem. I had lots of money on the go, but I remember that day distinctly because I thought, you need to go because I'm in trouble here.
So this is the first time on camera since this whole Epstein case that someone that close to Prince Andrew has testified that they saw him sweating. Mm. Just to expand on that a little bit, because I think people are going to really watch this and be interested. Could you describe where you saw him sweat?
Right, he was playing. Basically, what he would do is he would come out and literally knock the golf balls from the sort of ambassador's entrance. There's a rear sort of from the palace looking out towards the garden. There's a lake, so he would plot up his golf balls and whack them towards the lake. And on this particular occasion, he came out. Whether he was having a warm up because he was going to golf somewhere, I don't know. But on this particular occasion, the reason I said I remembered it because I needed to use the phone to do some trades on the stock market, and so he was interrupting me doing what I needed to do at that. I know it sounds funny and selfish, whatever you want to call it, but that was in the middle of all what was going on in my life. And so he spent about half hour. Probably 40 minutes hitting golf balls up, and he was sweating. I could see him, you know, wiping his forehead, and he was clearly sweating. You could, you know, as he walked past me, you could see the beads of sweat, which again is another issue I brought up when I watched the interview. And I thought, what are you talking about? You know, you do sweat.
Was there anything else that he said in that interview that you saw during your work that contradicts what we haven't talked about?
I can't, to be honest with you, I don't think so. I mean, we've covered most of it, haven't we?
Okay, let's move on to Ghislaine Maxwell then.
Yeah.
Because she was visiting him when you was a protection
yeah,
officer.
Yeah, I mean, she, the issues, again, which was published in the national press was because I said this 10 years ago, what happened. If we go back to when I said about the security post during the day, when appointments, you come, you give your name. When on this particular first occasion when I had calls to meet Ghislaine Maxwell was when the privy purse phoned down and said, we've got a guest coming in for Prince Andrew, but the name is not to be entered into the book. So that was the first one. So I was queried it. So why is that then? Why is she the only one we're not putting in? But he goes, because it's Ghislaine Maxwell.
What year was that?
Probably about 2001, roughly between 2001. It had to be between 2000, 2001, 2002, okay. Definitely. And So the query was, I queried it. I said, well, what's Ghislaine Maxwell? He said, well, because the name's not to go in the book. I said, why is that? He said, Ghislaine Maxwell. So, and then I thought, when we realised it was Robert Maxwell, the daughter of Robert Maxwell. And back in the day, that was, you know, he'd robbed the pension fund and he was, you know, not a particular flavour of the month. So we just found it strange that a person connected to Robert Maxwell be invited to Buckingham Palace. It's not really a good look for a member of the royal family to be seen associating with a person of this, you know, of this sort of stature. So said, no, that's fine anyway. Come the appointment, which was 11:30, I can't remember now. It was later on in the day. She turned up in a green Range Rover, being chauffeur driven in the passenger seat, and we would just let her go straight. The man gave her a name, we just let her go straight in. And about half hour, I think, after that, myself and my colleague walked through the garden to go back to the police lodge. We were relieved. And he was having a picnic with her. Quite a big, lavish picnic by the summer house, which is underneath, opposite the Queen's bedroom window. And again, we did laugh to ourselves and think, you know, does the Queen know who's sitting in her garden? You know, but that picnic was the first initial sort of introduction to Ghislaine Maxwell. And then we had the same sort of itinerary when she turned up, name not to go in the book. When this was during the day, because the nighttime ones, there was no book. So it was just a call up, and usually we'd have a name, but with him, as I say, we'd get no name. But it was the same protocol with her, which we found strange initially anyway.
Did you ever speak to Glenn?
No, she never spoke. She always just sat in the passenger seat and was driven straight through.
What's your interpretation now of the relationship, Andrew and Ghislaine?
I think they must have had a sexual relationship at some stage. They were very close. I mean, the picnics, you know, they were very, I wouldn't say intimate, I'm not going to say something to see, but they were close, you know. It was obvious that I think they probably had a sexual relationship at some stage during the period of time they'd known each other. And she was probably a very good friend of his. And I think she was a conduit to influential people. Because as we know now, and I'm not saying anything that other people don't know, he likes to surround himself with people with money and influence. And I think, you know, I mean, if you look at Sarah Ferguson, I mean, she's all about the money. I mean, she's been caught so many times trying to sell stories about Prince Andrew and all the rest of it. And his sort of circle of friends have been cultivated by Ghislaine Maxwell, because there's so many pictures out there. In fact, there's more pictures of him partying than there is at charity events, which is what I've said on my Twitter feed as well. You know, he says, oh, I wasn't so much of a party anymore. Well, let's go back through all you've got to do, Your Highness, is go on Google and Google yourself, and you'll find a lot more pictures of you at parties than you are at, you know, charity events.
People watching this are going to want to go down and click on your Twitter. So Paul's Twitter is going to be in the description box below this video. Do you just want to state your Twitter handle to the viewers?
Yeah, it's either Paul Page, ex-RoyalCop, or ex-RoyalCop Paul Page, but it'll come up. You'll see it.
So I'm reading, more than halfway through now, The Assassination of Robert Maxwell. And what I've put together from my research and interviewing other people is that Ghislaine started to go out with Epstein. Maxwell caught wind of this, and he introduced Epstein into the Mossad fold. And then you've got, you know, links into trafficking in arms, weapons, kids, money laundering. They're like the four principal ways these guys make money. So you were around 2001, 2002, you said, with Ghislaine. This predates that. That's around the time Clinton was on the Lolita Express, from those years after he became the president. Do you think then that Ghislaine, because Andrew, it seems that he's throwing Ghislaine under the bus in the interview, he keeps blaming her. Do you think that Ghislaine has got more responsibility than is being made out, or that she is this super deviant, super villain character?
I think I think what's interesting is, unless you've worked in an environment where you're mixing with upper echelons, we're going to call them the upper echelons of society. I'm not saying they're any better than you or me, because they're clearly not. A lot of them aren't. But I'm talking about the super high net worth people and the government officials and presidents and prime ministers and all these people, that you know, they've got a different outlook on life than me and you. Not, we're just normal people. And the people that probably watch your podcast, we're normal people. You get a very blinkered view of what life is like in that world. You only get snippets of when something happens and people come out and start talking. But that environment is a very strange environment in terms of the way the upper class perceive right and wrong. So what we know to be right in life and society and morally, not necessarily what these people obviously think. And I've come across that a lot in people when I've dealt with them. And the way they perceive their actions to be immune from, you know, prosecution, or even like people just saying, well, actually that's wrong. Well, why would you say that? Look, you're just a normal peasant. You know, what would you know? And this is the problem you've got. Your Ghislaine Maxwells and all those high net worth individuals have got this preconception that they can treat people the way they want, talk down to, like Prince Andrew, I've given the examples of the way he acts and the way he treats people and the way he has got a contempt for protocol. And that's no different from Ghislaine Maxwell and those type of people, because clearly they're running circles where they can get what they want whenever they want. And this is the point of what's happened with Epstein. Epstein is clearly an individual that enjoys power and enjoyed manipulating and child sex exploitation for his own benefits and sharing that out by the looks of it with others. But never thought that anything was going to come of it. And I think part of that confidence would have come with being a friend of a member of the royal family, because he's mixing in higher circles. So whether or not, and this is the issue I've got, whether or not Prince Andrew was brought in to be a friend to Epstein to give him the air of respectability that he may well have needed, or immunity that he may have felt that he would sort of have with a member of the royal family. That's my question. That's what I'm playing in my head right now. Whether or not, because if you've got Prince Andrew along, is it less likely or more likely that you're going to get your collar felt?
With the public clamouring for someone to pay the price and this Epstein case, the only people have been arrested so far, two guards who simultaneously fell asleep the night that Epstein, it went down, suiciding. And you've got Ghislaine Maxwell introducing Epstein to Andrew throughout the BBC interview. Mm. Andrew saying, you know, my relationship was Ghislaine, Epstein was the plus one. Mm. It was almost as if he's shaping her up to take responsibility. Do you think that Maxwell will be sacrificed to satisfy the public demand for justice in this case, because she was Epstein's right-hand person?
I think she's not going to be afforded the same protection as Prince Andrew, most definitely, in terms of the FBI and whatever investigation that's going on. She's not going to be given that same protection that probably Andrew is afforded, as we've already discussed about issues surrounding the allegations made. So potentially she could face charges. But how those charges are shaped are going to be dependent on what the allegations are against her. We've got trafficking so far. Prince Andrew, the issue with Prince Andrew is he's now, as you say, he's trying to distance himself with Ghislaine Maxwell. Well, he's obviously been advised to do that, because potentially he could have been told that she's going to be facing charges, but you're not. But I can't see that Ghislaine Maxwell is going to give any information against Prince Andrew. I just can't see it myself. She should face indictment, definitely. She's obviously, you know, guilty of a number of crimes, but how that plays out in a US court is your guess is as good as mine.
So we read all these news stories saying she's here and there and everywhere, all nonsense, of course, red herrings. We also had these news stories saying that, you know, Prince Philip's so angry with Andrew right now, Prince Charles is so angry, the Queen's going to lock Andrew up in the Tower of London for this. Did you have interactions with the Queen, and what do you think her real reaction would be to all of this?
As a protection officer, the only interactions you would have with her as such, unless you're a personal protection officer, but then even then, I don't think she would express her distaste amongst a family member. For me, I've met her on quite a number of occasions, but that was only just to salute because you don't speak to the Queen, she speaks to you. You're not allowed to say good morning unless she speaks to you. You've just got to stand there like a dummy. So it was just about, I've only ever spoken to about the weather. I hadn't seen her, obviously, at that period of time with Prince Andrew. But she well knows what Prince Andrew was like with the staff. She well knows that he was the most unpopular member of the royal family amongst the staff and police officers who worked at Buckingham Palace because of his rudeness. I've said this before, even his personal valet of over 25 years, who is like his butler, was with him, didn't like him. It's, if you look through the national press, other members of the royal household have come out and said how Prince Andrew is verbally abusive towards them. And in fact, his private personal valet of 25 years, I used to know him quite well, used to see him at night. So we used to take Prince Andrew's Jack Russell for a walk. When it used to wake him up, Prince Andrew would press his raw button and the poor valet would have to come out and take the dog and take him out into the back garden for a walk round. And I used to speak to him on a regular basis, and even he didn't like Prince Andrew. In fact, on one occasion, Prince Andrew was going skiing, and the valet said, at least he'll be away for the week. Hopefully he'll ski off a fucking cliff. You know, and this is someone who's known him for 25 years. So That just gives you a measure of the man, the real Prince Andrew. I mean, if people, you know, people can choose to listen and believe what I say, and they choose not to believe. But what I'd say is there's plenty of other people that are now coming out of the woodwork from the royal palaces speaking about how, you know, unpleasant Prince Andrew is, you know.
Did you have any interactions with Fergie?
No, I didn't have. Fortunately, I didn't have any interactions with her. She very rarely, I can't remember attending the palace when I was there, to be fair. If I was going to talk about if there was any polite members of the royal family, let's put it that way. Don't get me wrong. I mean, the Queen's like an old woman at the end of the day. People say, I hate the Queen. That's fine. Everyone's got to talk to their opinion about members of the royal family, but sometimes you've got to take people at their face value. Do you know what I mean? And she was never rude to me. And that's what I see as a plus point. Prince Philip was grumpy. I mean, on one occasion, I think that's where Prince Andrew gets his volatility from, because Prince Philip likes to swear. On one occasion, I remember, was in the garden, and they used to have the guardsmen at night used to walk up and down. There's gravel outside the Queen's bedroom, and then there's grass. But the soldiers used to walk along the gravel. Now, Prince Philip used to leave his window open about 6-8 inches to get fresh air, because they've got separate apartments. They don't sleep together, the Queen. Not saying that that's anything wrong with it, but they've got their own separate bedrooms. And so he used to keep his window open about 6 inches. And I remember these two young guardsmen, they were walking down, and they didn't realise what they were doing. They started kicking the gravel. And they were walking past Prince Philip's bedroom window, and he yanked the bedroom window up and he said, "Will you fuck off that gravel?" He told her to fuck right off. And I was in the post at the time, and I just shriveled down in my chair and tried to hide, just hide in the shadows and waited for him to slam. He slammed the window shut. The next thing you know, the regimental sergeant major came marching out with two other soldiers, got these two poor kids, marched them back, replaced them with two others, and took them back to the guard room. God knows what happened to them. But that was all because, and after that, we weren't allowed to walk on the gravel.
Wow.
We were banned from walking on the gravel in case it woke Prince Philip up. But the nicest were the two boys. I only knew them when they were kids, but they would always wave. I'd work at different palaces, and if I'd see them at Kensington or St. James's Palace, they'd all always wave and stop and say hello to the police officers. None of the others did that, but obviously they got that from their mum.
What about the girls, Prince Andrew's kids? Did you interact with them?
Not really. They were very young back then. So I didn't really, to be fair, I didn't really see it, because that's what confuses me, because I was a family man and this and that. But he spent a lot of his time on his own at the palace. Didn't see the young girls a lot, you know. So Harry, he makes this argument for he was such a family man back in the day. I'm not really feeling that, I'll be honest with you, because my colleagues would say the same, that they very rarely saw the children at Buckingham Palace, where he spent the majority of his time, apart from the weekends. So
today we've focused on the Epstein, Prince Andrew, Ghislaine Maxwell story. I mean, you've got a huge story yourself, and if people want to check it out, they should go on Amazon. It's a paperback and a Kindle, and read this book. It's not written by you, but it features your story. I'm sure people watching this are going to have loads of questions for you. Put those questions in the comments below this video. People are going to probably be demanding we get you back on, because you did end up getting in trouble. You were running a stock market scheme as a royal protection officer. and it got out, you got in massive debt, and it ended up collapsing. And you did prison time yourself, so there's a whole you got hours and hours of more content. So if people want to read it, or people want if you would like to see Paul come back on the podcast, if you've got questions for him, please put all that down in the comments below this. So in summary then, just as final question on what we've touched on today, how do you think this whole situation with Maxwell and Prince Andrew plays out in 2020?
Well, as I said, and I'll stand by my guns, that Prince Andrew is not going to be indicted for anything. I'm pretty certain of that, given the stuff that I've not talked about everything within the palace and what happens there, but given what I know about the royal household and the way mechanics work and the way the establishment works, because let's not forget, I was part of that establishment at one stage, and I was doing their bidding, as people would say. You know, I was turning a blind eye. Yes, I was. You know, that's fine and dandy. But from what I know, I can honestly say that I cannot see Prince Andrew, for the reasons I've given as well. Obviously, speaking publicly, if you're looking at being arrested for something, you're hardly going to go on telly and start talking about it, because obviously that's your story's full of holes. And if you're going to change your story, it's too late. So that's one of the main reasons why I think that he's not. And obviously the second reason is because he's part of the establishment. Ghislaine Maxwell, on the other hand, we keep hearing about there's evidence, but at the moment we've not really seen anything. In an investigation, you're not really going to see the real evidence, because it could damage a potential case. So I know there's a lot of people out there screaming for evidence and what's going on, but you need to understand, if it's an ongoing live investigation, and there's as many people as been affected as we suspect, then you're going to have to be patient and see what comes out of it, because the police and the FBI and all the other agencies are not going to start pumping out information about crimes that they're investigating. That's just not how it works.
An investigation this big and complex takes a lot of time to get all the data before the indictments come down.
It could take a lot longer than 2020. It could go into 2021. You know, so you've got to remember, they're not going to risk indictments and prosecutions to give the public, throw the public a bone. That's not how it works. But as I said, Ghislaine Maxwell, she's not come out and publicly fought a corner. Prince Andrew has. My indication on that is she may well be looking at prosecution, so that's why she's been told to keep her mouth shut. Prince Andrew, on the other hand, has decided to come out public, which indicates to me that he's quite safe in the knowledge that he's not going to be prosecuted for anything.
Some people watching this video will want to contact you or support you on your platforms. What is your preferred method of people contacting you?
They can just get on Twitter. Go on Twitter. I'm on there. That's the only, to be honest with you, that's the only thing I'm on. So they can go on there and I'll always get back to them.
And like I said, I'm going to put the Ian Puddick clip also in the description box below this video. If you have enjoyed this video and our other videos, we do appreciate you subscribing to the channel. Subscription logo is in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen. We also appreciate all the people who've donated to the channel on PayPal, Patreon, Just Giving. This enables us to go out with a full camera crew, sound engineer, cameraman, and do these videos at the production level that we're getting them to you here today. Huge thank you to all of the new subscribers. Wishing everybody a great 2020, and let's see what is going to develop with this Epstein case. I guess karate guys, we do us, don't we? Us. Us. I can do that Arizona prison handshake. Arizona prison handshake is this.
That's it. And that as well, yeah.
Thanks for your time, Paul. That's really appreciate it. Cheers.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.